From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Where are you from? What are you? Born to a black father and white mother, Julie Lithcott-Hames faced questions about her identity, questions tinged with suspicion. The racism and isolation she experienced as a teen wounded her self-confidence, despite her parents' best efforts.
I could have used a lot more than dolls and books written by black authors. They chose to raise me in white communities, which I think, if we had the opportunity to go back and do it all again, we would do differently.
In her memoir, Real American, Hames describes her painful search for belonging and her journey to self-acceptance. What does it mean to be a real American? It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Much to think about on this day honoring Martin Luther King Jr. Recent remarks by President Trump underscored that the work of racial reconciliation is far from done. It seems like a good morning to reflect on the interview we did last fall with Julie Lithcott-Hames. She was born to an African-American father and a white British mother. They married in Ghana in 1966, a time when their union was illegal in more than a dozen U.S. states. Julie was born the next year. Having a successful physician as a father and a mother who read her the works of black authors was no barrier against the racism Julie would face growing up in a white town in Wisconsin. And it was no comfort against society's negative messages about blackness. Feelings of self-doubt and insecurity followed her throughout college, into her career, even into parenthood. But finally achieving self-acceptance gave her insight into what it really means to be black in America. For more than a decade, Julie Lithcott-Hames was dean of freshman and undergraduate advising at Stanford University. She's the best-selling author of How to Raise an Adult. In October, we discussed her newest book titled Real American, a Memoir. I noted that her father had been on the faculty of Columbia University, then vice chancellor of the University of Wisconsin, and then assistant U.S. Surgeon General appointed by President Jimmy Carter. I asked what effect it had on her childhood to move around so much.
It's hard to imagine my childhood any other way. It's the only childhood I lived. I think it gave me the sense that it was possible to reinvent myself, that it was possible to start anew. I think that served me well in my adulthood. At the same time, I never had to go through the work of staying, of sticking something out. I also didn't have the pleasure of deep friendships that lasted over 5, 10, 15 years. I don't have memories of that have a very long thread.
You write that your mother was, quote, the blackest white lady, close quote, you knew. She bought you black dolls. She wore dresses made of cloth from Nigeria. But you write those measures sometimes felt annoying to you. Why?
It was the 1970s, and a white mother of a black biracial child was told at the time that it's important for this child to have black dolls and important for this child to read books with black characters. Those things were hard to find in those times, but my mother made the effort. She was doing her best as a white woman raising me, to raise me so that I would love myself, so that I would feel that I had a right to be here, and so that I could withstand the critiques and criticisms and dismissals that one might say would inevitably come the way of a black child in America. But what I found difficult was, even as a child, I knew it was an effort. And I, like any child, wanted to be normal, wanted a normal child, wanted a normal child who didn't want to seem different. So when my world was full of white friends, and my mother said, here, read this book, and I knew my white friends didn't have that book, I began to realize that there was a sense that maybe I needed to be treated differently because of my blackness. I couldn't appreciate it as a child that it was for the very purpose of building in me a stronger self-esteem than might otherwise come. I just realized, wait a minute, I'm being treated differently, or my experience is different, or I should have different books and dolls because of my skin color.
I can imagine how hard that was. on the other hand, looking back on it, did it arm you with skills and attitudes that have been helpful? I mean, would it have been better not to do that?
No. Those things were very important, and they remain essential for any child today, any child of color growing up in America. We need to see ourselves reflected in literature and in posters and in media. It's good for the healthy psychological development of any child to see themselves reflected in the world. So these efforts were fantastic. They were just not enough. And because I think, you know, my parents were doing this, this was an interracial experiment in some ways. Their marriage in 66, my birth in 67, they didn't have experience raising a child like me until they had a child like me. So I guess what I'm saying is it was complicated. The efforts were well-intended, and I think they were, I could have used a lot more than dolls and books written by Black authors. They chose to raise me in white communities, which I think if we had the opportunity to go back and do it all again, we would do differently.
What messages did you get about being Black from your father?
My father was born in 1918, which meant he was close to 50 when I was born, and there was a lot he wouldn't talk about. There was so much pain from the Jim Crow childhood he had endured in Oklahoma. He would tell jokes, but rarely delve deeply into the heart of the stories. One of the realities of his youth and young adulthood was about how the boundary between being friends with a white person and dating a white person. So one of the things he said to me when I was an adolescent in Middleton, Wisconsin, going to a high school that was all white, 1,200 kids, a handful of Jewish kids, me, nobody else that brought any diversity really to speak of. You know, so I had this crush on this boy, this white boy. They were only white boys there. Who else was I going to have a crush on? And somebody snapped a photograph of me laughing with this boy. And you can see in the photograph that we're just delighted in our friendship. And of course, I had stronger feelings. And my daddy looked at that photo and said, "White boys will be your friend, but they'll never date you." And I didn't know how to say to him, how to express the anguish in my heart, which was, then why did you move me to a town with only white people? If that is in fact true, Daddy, if that is your truth from your upbringing, if it is in fact still true today, why the heck did you make this choice to plunk me down here to spend my adolescence in these cornfields where apparently no one's going to date me? So I revered him. I trusted him. I trusted that he was looking out for me and trying to do right by me. I think they chose kind of the bigger house in the quote unquote better school district. But I'm not in the aggregate, I think there was a more diverse school in Madison that I might have attended where I could have had a great education that included being in community with fellow Black students.
One of the toughest memories you share is when a birthday card on your high school locker is defaced with the N-word, and you don't tell anyone. You don't even let yourself get visibly upset. Why keep this and other similar experiences? Why keep them a secret?
Shame, embarrassment, humiliation. I was the only brown-skinned person in my school. I was the student body president when this happened. I was making it. I was doing well. I was college-bound. I was on the pom-pom team. I was in the, you know, state award-winning choir. And so there was a sort of successful patina to my adolescence and high school experience. So when this happened, it completely pulled the floor out from under me. I didn't tell anybody because there was really no one to tell. My best friend said things she intended to be kind, things like, "I don't think of you as Black. I think of you as normal. So how do I turn to that person and say, this just happened to me?" I didn't tell my parents. They were perhaps the only ones that would have reached an outstretched hand and pulled me back up to my feet. But I knew my parents would make an issue out of it. And the last thing I wanted was for anyone to know both that it happened and that I had been hurt by it.
Why was
the trouble was it then festered in me for about 25 years. I didn't actually tell anyone until I was about 40. And I realized that it was the first of not the first, but the most painful early childhood experience that then became an experience that attached itself to others and others and others and others and so on. And I think I spent 2 decades trying never to be called that word again.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kass, speaking with Julie Lithcott-Hames, author of the memoir Real American, about her journey to self-acceptance as a biracial Black woman. You grew up before the term biracial was commonly used, and you faced questions from white people like, where are you from and what are you? Two questions that make you feel like a foreigner in your home. Describe that feeling.
Yeah, and people hear that still today. Biracial was a new term. It really came into being in the late 80s, and I clung to it like a life preserver because it was the first time I was given a way to describe myself that didn't require rejecting my white mother. Where are you from? What are you? These questions, look, there's an easy way. I know some people are listening going, lady, what's the problem? Of course we're curious about everyone else. Yes, there's natural curiosity we all have about one another when we meet somebody new, you know, where are you from? As opposed to, where are you from? Which has a tone about it that implies, I don't think I know what kind of human you are. And then the probing goes further. You say, I'm from here. And they say, no, but where are you from? And I know, you know, Asian Americans listening to this, Latinos and Hispanics listening to this, in addition to Black folks, are nodding their heads because we are the folks who are asked that question. This, the effort to pinpoint, how do I classify you racially or ethnically? I need to classify you racially or ethnically because I need to know kind of where you stack up in the hierarchy of Americans.
During a new student orientation at Stanford, you attended an event at the school's African-American-themed dorm. And instead of feeling at home, you felt incredibly out of place.
Yeah. So I'd come from this high school with myself and 1,199 white folks. And now I'm at Stanford. It's 1985. Stanford at the time had about, 8% of the population were Black students. And so I thought, yes, finally, I'm going to get a chance to have Black friends. And, you know, up until this point, I was watching The Cosby Show on Thursday nights on NBC to get clues about how to be myself. Mm. So now I'm looking forward to meeting Black kids. And I go to an event, and it seems as I approach it as if everybody knows each other already, which isn't possible because, you know, many of us are newcomers, new freshmen. I clung to the wall. I hid in the background. I looked at these other kids interacting with each other, and I felt that as they looked at me and looked away, that they were seeing my white mother in me, that they knew that I had attended an all-white high school. Now, obviously, not I'm projecting, right? But that's how I felt. I thought, oh my gosh, I am an outsider here too. I thought, the minute I was around Black people, I might, you know, a community, a grouping of Black people, I might feel a sense of belonging. And what I now know at age 49 is my own self-loathing as a Black person was really getting cemented. And so I was almost rejecting of the Black community, even while trying to join it. And so I'm sure the look on my face was one of, I don't belong here. You know, I'm not in community with you. And that's, I'm sure, the energy and the look that I was projecting to my potential new classmates. I understand this all now, decades later. But in that moment, I simply felt, well, gee, I don't know that I'm going to fit in here either. And it led me to this feeling of being on an island. And not just an island vis-a-vis peers, but no one in my family is biracial either. You know, Black dad, white mom, I'm the only product of the two of them. And so there was really nobody that I knew who'd had this weird, strange upbringing. And I say weird and strange because the feedback I was getting all around me was that my upbringing and the way that I looked was weird and strange.
And then you started to embrace your whole self when you were back at Stanford as dean of freshmen with help from an unusual source, a yeah. Buddhist Aikido master who's brought in by Stanford as an executive coach. What was that sense of relief like?
Well, I want to give a shout out to my Buddhist Aikido master, Mary Ellen Myers, an executive coach brought in to help a team of us get along better in the workplace at Stanford, which was a terrific thing. At first, I thought my job was to tell her what was wrong with everyone else. And then I realized, whoa, wait, there's feedback for me, too. And she was able to tell me that in the team dynamic, I was viewed as impulsive, emotional, often too angry, often too passionate. And when she told me this, I said, are you kidding me? This is the stereotype of Black women. Is this actually in writing and you're handing it to me? You can't do that. And she smiled and she said, how's it working for you? And I stammered and I said, well, actually, it's not working very well, because when I do show up with a reflexive, reactive, impulsive anger or delight or passion or whatever it is, and I'm sort of too big for the moment or the table or the room, then often I'm the one that has to go back and circle around and apologize for overreacting or jumping in too soon or what have you. And she nodded her head and she said, so here's the deal. If you can figure out what's triggering you to be so big and so emotional, then you can be more in charge, Julie. You can be in charge of whether that thought leads to a response from you or not. And you get to decide what that response is instead of it being a reflex you can't control. So Mary Ellen wasn't telling me to quiet my Black self. She was telling me to channel my power by being a little bit more thoughtful and controlled about when and how I spoke. And that was life-changing. But it first required me to appreciate that the triggers in the first place that were resulting in this reflexive big reaction, those were triggers around, I think someone is disregarding my opinion. I think they don't think I'm smart enough. I think they don't think I'm hardworking. I think they're not listening to me. And the root of all of that fear, of course, for me was around my Blackness. Again, that N-word lingering in my psyche. I was just desperate. It was like every critique was one or two steps away from possibly calling me that. And I'm not saying that was on anyone's mind. I'm saying in my mind, in my subconscious mind, that was what I was afraid of letting happen. And so I had to kind of jump out and prevent it.
We need to take a quick break now. Julie Lithcott-Hames, author of Real American, a memoir, will stick with us and we'll talk about parenting Black and biracial children in the era of Black Lives Matter. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with best-selling author and former Stanford University Dean Julie Lithcott-Hames. Her new book is Real American, a memoir. In it, she describes the isolation of growing up Black and biracial in mostly white Wisconsin and the struggle to accept herself in a society that viewed her as inferior. During your time at Stanford, you met your partner, Dan, who is white, and you write it was inevitable that you would marry a white man. Why?
My husband, Dan, is an amazing human. He's white and Jewish. We've been together 30 years, married 25. I say it was inevitable because my upbringing was white, and so I had only ever dated white guys. And I was kind of about pleasing the white community and being good enough in their eyes. And so in that sense, I think the goal or the sort of hope is that, and I will make it into white society, you know, by having a white husband. I didn't consciously think this or plan this. I'm saying in retrospect, I can see that that was the trajectory I was on. But I also say that Dan wasn't inevitable. Dan is inevitable in his whiteness in terms of the trajectory of my life, but he was a gift to me because he was actually a white man who loved my Blackness. He saw me with my hair wet one day. I tried hard never to let anyone see my hair curly and wet, frizzy, untamable. He saw me come out of the shower one day in our dorm. I was in my robe. He noticed that my hair was coiled into these corkscrews clinging to my face and my neck. And he said, "You have curly hair." He didn't know after dating me for 4 months. And I was frightened. I said, "Yeah." Because all those white boys who teased me about my hair in high school, their taunting was coming back into my consciousness as he said this. And I recoiled from him. And he leaned toward me and he said, "I love it." And I thought, my goodness, this man loves my black hair. I don't even love it. I'm not even sure I love myself. And so the gift of Dan was being able to be in a relationship with somebody really without regard to his skin color, who was loving me for me and seeing me more clearly than I was able to see myself and loving all of it.
You are the parent of two teens, a boy and a girl.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you to read an excerpt from your book about what you tell them about their ancestry.
All right, so here is the reading from page 159 of my book. My children are Sawyer and Avery, by the way. Here we go. When Sawyer and Avery are still quite young, I begin my new and improved version of my parents' political advocacy campaign, which was, "You are black." My campaign goes like this. "You are part black, Eastern European Jew, and Yorkshire coal miner. Your ancestors were some of the most reviled people in history. Be proud of that and of them. You have the right to be here. You come from people who survived." I try to say it not as declaration or dare, as my parents' line had sometimes felt to me, but as support, as a kind of reassurance that might become a part of the structure of their developing minds, as ballast when the destabilization comes at them from wherever it might come.
Thank you. How are your choices different from the ones your parents made?
Oh, Sheila. I wish I could say I've done it all right. I wish I could say I had figured all this out before ever giving birth to a child whom I would have to teach and guide and nurture through this journey of life. I've done better in some respects, and I've made the same mistakes in some respects. I've done better in this sense. I found a deep sense of belonging in the San Francisco Bay Area when I moved there for college. Really, I've not left since college except for 3 years back east in law school. It's the first place where I haven't been, you know, singled out as the sore thumb or the what are you. There's so much rich diversity in the Bay Area that I feel a sense of belonging. My family feels like it belongs. We look in some ways like everybody else in that quote-unquote everybody is there. So I made that choice, and I'm raising my children there. At the same time, I went for the better public schools. And in my neck of the woods, that's Palo Alto Unified School District. And it's a magnificent school district with very high test scores and the high real estate prices to support that. And it's diverse. It's much more diverse than Middleton High School. But its diversity is about 40% Asian, including Chinese American, Korean American, Indian American, and others, about 40% white, or maybe 42% white. And then I think that leaves about 18% for everybody else, a very small percentage of black, maybe 2-3% black, if that, a larger percentage of Latinos. So I have failed to raise my children in a black community. And I often look across the San Francisco Bay at Oakland, California, and Berkeley, and think, if I had had the consciousness back then when my kids were little that I do now, I probably would have said, guys, let's raise these kids in the East Bay in Oakland or Berkeley, even though it would have meant a long commute to my job at Stanford. I think being raised in a community with other people who literally look like them, who can extend that outstretched hand if and when the bad thing happens and can say, I've been there, you'll be all right. You know, we can sit together, we can unpack this together, you're not alone. I wish I had done that for them, and I didn't. And it's not a decision one can easily undo.
That's Julie Lithcott-Hames, whose memoir is titled Real American. She describes her search for self-acceptance as a biracial black woman. How have the police shootings of unarmed African-American men and boys affected how you've raised your son, Sawyer?
Yeah, and I'll add in women, too. I tend to focus on the men and boys in my book, but of course it's happening to women and girls, too. It's terrifying, Sheila. It's terrifying. I think video, social media have allowed us a lens into what has been happening always. I don't know that anyone knows that the incidents are increasing. I think we know that we're just seeing them thanks to media. And it's terrifying. And I'm someone who's upper middle class. You know, my education and upbringing have afforded me a privilege of class privilege. I've got light skin. We live in a community where you're not likely to be pulled over by the police for much. But I know that that my brown son, my African-American son, he is very mixed, but he phenotypically looks black. When he goes out into the world, in the minds of some people, he will be presumed to be the bad actor, the thug, the criminal, etc. And so we have the talk with our with our children, which entails how to behave if something goes down, if you get pulled over or you're in a situation. You raise your hands in the air. You're extremely respectful. Even if you know you've done nothing wrong, you do not argue for yourself. You do not defend yourself. What's terrifying about it is complex because the terror is the potential that they might be harmed at the hands of someone who presumes brown skin equals threat. It's also terrifying to think of what we're doing to their developing psyches to have the talk in the damn first place, okay? How do you tell somebody people might mistreat you on the basis of your skin color? So here's what you do to protect yourself. How do you simultaneously teach them to love themselves in the face of that? That is our challenge as Black parents, and we work very, very hard to strike the right balance.
Thank you. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks, Sheila. Really appreciate being with you.
Real American, a memoir by best-selling author and former Stanford University Dean Julie Lithcott-Hames, is out in hardback now. The paperback is scheduled for September. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for spending part of your Martin Luther King Day with us. Hope you have a good day, and you'll join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.